Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is calling today for a $2 trillion infrastructure bill to boost the economy, which has been ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic. The death toll in the United States is now above 3,000, which is three times higher than it was just last Thursday. Hospitals in many states are already overwhelmed or fear they will be soon.
And many prisons are as well, Jeremy. We're going to start in California, where there's a debate about what to do with overcrowded prisons in the age of coronavirus. The state has more than 7,000 confirmed cases, some inside jails and prisons. Reporter Susie Nelson has been following this story from member station KQED in San Francisco. And Susie, this month, San Francisco started reducing its jail population by 25%. So who's getting released? Where do they go?
So that's a great question. San Francisco is one of many counties targeting individuals for early release right now. And District Attorney Chazza Boudin has said he only wants to keep people in jails who pose a risk to public safety. So they're releasing low-level offenders, people with 90 days or fewer on their sentences, and medically fragile individuals. Yeah. As for where they're going, most of them, like us, are going home and staying there.
Yeah. Well,
that also poses the question. Oh, sorry, yes?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That also poses the question, what about people without homes? In some Bay Area counties, reentry services have been shut down, so there are concerns about the homeless population.
Well, that was going to be my question. So people are concerned about people with no homes. And as you know, California's Governor Gavin Newsom has resisted this kind of talk. He says he won't release violent offenders or large numbers of prisoners statewide, even though, as you just said, the goal is to reduce, to release people with, you know, who are not violent offenders. What are other local governments doing?
So that's a great question as well. The challenge with jails is that they're managed locally, so you can't always coordinate a response the way that you can in state prisons. But it does appear that many counties are taking this seriously anyway and trying to reduce their populations. Santa Clara County, which is one of the largest COVID hotspots in the state, has reduced the jail population from 3,300 to 2,600 in just a few weeks. And many counties are also reducing the number of people they arrest and the types of things they arrest them for.
Well, prisoners around the world are worried about this. Italy and Iran had violent prison riots during the pandemic. We know there's been issues at Rikers Island Prison in New York. You know, obviously the concern is that these people are packed into cells and it could really spread like wildfire.
Yeah, that is a really good point. And, you know, California's jails are very overcrowded, and that's partly because of a push some years ago to get people out of prisons. A lot of those people went into the county jail system. And I've been talking with jail inmates a lot for the last 10 days or so, and they all echo similar concerns. So one inmate I spoke with, his name is John. He has type 2 diabetes, and he says that he's been trying to get insulin delivered to his bunk because he's afraid of going into public spaces, and he has not been able to get it delivered, so he has been without insulin for over a week. Mm. And John, like other inmates, is also afraid of the fact that in his bunks and many bunks of other inmates are spaced only a few feet apart, so they can't practice social distancing in their bunks. Mm. And when they're going out into common spaces, those spaces are often unsanitary and they are also very crowded. So we're seeing a lot of concerns in California's jail system right now.
Well, and of course, the prison staff is at risk as well. Susie Nelson from member station KQED in San Francisco, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, now let's go overseas to France. The Eiffel Tower opened in Paris on this day in 1889, but there will be no events marking that anniversary. The tower is closed today, and France is on lockdown as the coronavirus death toll there exceeds 3,000. Joining us now is the BBC's Hugh Schofield outside of Paris. And Hugh, France had its highest daily jump in the numbers of deaths yesterday. Are there any positive signs that the lockdown is making a difference?
I mean, not really, but then I don't think anyone would be expecting it to just yet. The lockdown is broadly being observed. There are, you know, very, very stringent rules governing how people behave and interact and so on. And that should have an effect. And the fact that it's not yet slowing down the rate of growth does not necessarily mean that it won't do what it's supposed to do. And we should know that in the coming days, I think.
Still, when you look at the numbers and you look at a place like Italy, 100 plus thousand cases, more than 11,000 deaths. Spain, almost 100,000 cases, more than 8,000 deaths, but France down at about 45,000 cases and only 3,000 deaths. Does that say to you that France is simply behind those countries in terms of the outbreak, or that France is doing a much better job in dealing with it?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not an expert. I mean, there are so many variables here to draw any conclusions. I would say, though, that the French system is good. You know, it's a very centralized system of health. And when there is an emergency, things kick in with, you know, with efficiency. You know, there's an awful lot to be proud of, I think, in the way the country has reacted. But then the Italians and the Spaniards are saying the same thing. So it's very hard to draw any conclusions.
Well, what is life like in France? When you go outside, do you go outside? And if you do you wear a mask? Do you see other people?
Yeah, I mean, I've managed to escape, like a lot of people, from Paris before the lockdown came in. And I'm living about 100 miles south of Paris in a rural area, but with small towns nearby. The small town near me, we all are following the rules exactly as you would in the city. No, you don't go out except for the exceptional reasons, such as buying food or having a short daily exercise every day. And in the small town near me, there's several big supermarkets there. There are queues outside the supermarkets because the supermarkets are only allowing so many people in at a time. Many of them will be wearing masks. I wear a mask. I'm lucky enough to have a mask from the BBC, so I will wear that. And the police are out, and they are checking, I mean, much more rigorously than I expected. You know, they are imposing fines. I mean, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of fines have been imposed on people who have not satisfied the gendarme that their excursion is for legitimate purposes.
That is the BBC's Hugh Schofield looking at the situation in France. Hugh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, believe it or not, with all of the troubling news that is out there, there are some slivers of good news emerging. And NPR Global Health and Development correspondent Jason Beaubien joins us now with more on that. Jason, you have monitored outbreaks across this country and noted that some of them appear more contained than others. Where are hospitalizations down and why might that be?
It is really interesting when you look across the country at the moment and you start looking at the differences between states. If you take Washington State, California, and New York State, these are all states that on the first week of March had about 100 cases. Now Washington has 5,000, California has 6,000, and New York State has 66,000. So very different outbreaks that are playing out in different places. But then if you also kind of go and look, there are other places across the country like, you know, New Mexico, Oregon, Minnesota. Again, almost no cases in the first week of March, and they're still down with just a few hundred cases. So you are seeing places where you are not getting these explosive outbreaks, and you are seeing places like New York, Michigan, Florida, Louisiana, where you are seeing these sort of explosive outbreaks.
Well, and one of the things that experts have pointed to is social distancing, which we're all hopefully doing at this point in this country, that it has also had a positive side effect, which is that the seasonal flu, which kills thousands every year, hasn't spread like it usually does.
It's quite interesting. If you look at the CDC's monitoring data, and the flu often changes from year to year, so it's a little hard to really pin it down. But right about the end of March last year, the flu was still very much at just coming off the peak. This year, it is definitely down. You see a steep drop before the last week in March. And there is some data outside this country to really support this. In Asian countries, they saw dramatic drops in flu when they started social distancing and these other measures earlier. Hong Kong did a study and looked at the flu rates in February after social distancing measures were put in late January, and they saw about a 44% drop in flu from what they would have expected based on these social distancing measures which are being put into place for COVID-19. But they were having this spillover effect of really helping with the flu.
And what about in general? Are there signs that the social distancing efforts that states in this country have taken are having the desired effect, or how will we know that?
You know, it's going to be difficult to really tease that out this early in this outbreak. We are seeing that things are playing out differently in different places, as I mentioned. And I think that is really the lesson. We saw this in Asia. We saw this in other places in the world where the measures that were put in place early, they are the places that had the lowest cases in the end. I mean, it is kind of interesting. If you look at like California, they went in about the same time with the declaration of state of emergency. Washington State, however, started about a week before New York. And you have to start to question whether that really made the difference, that 1 week of having the government completely engaged, saying we are in a state of emergency a week earlier than New York, made a difference there. Obviously, we don't really know, but it does seem that we've seen examples elsewhere in the world where these measures that get put in place early, they get put in place aggressively, and people really follow them, that those are the places that have ended up with fewer cases.
Well, and as economist Diane Swonk told us the other day, nobody is going to look back and say, I did too much. They might look back and say, I didn't do enough. That is Jason Bobe, an NPR Global Health and Development correspondent. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And this week, we're looking at what it means to be immunocompromised, to be more vulnerable to COVID-19. Well, for one thing, as John Boyle, president of the Immune Deficiency Foundation, says, the world is getting a taste of what he and others deal with every day. He said that to Drew Joseph, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. So, Drew, start there. These people are always distancing.
Yeah, exactly. These are people for whom social distancing is not exactly a new practice. They're used to washing their hands rigorously and thinking about who's coming into their house and, you know, sometimes have to cancel on family events if someone is sick. But they're taking precautions that they never have before with the coronavirus.
Well, let's hear about some of that. Who are some of these populations? What do they have?
People with conditions like heart disease or lung disease or kidney disease, and also people who are immunocompromised. And that can be people who have conditions of the immune system. So they're basically their immune system doesn't have the full suite of defenses that other people do, or people who are immunosuppressed, maybe because they're on chemotherapy, for example, or received an organ transplant, so have to take immunosuppression drugs.
Well, let's start with a conversation you had with the head of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. So what are their concerns, for instance?
Right. So people with CF, cystic fibrosis, that's a disease that makes people susceptible to pulmonary lung infections just generally. So cold and flu season is already a heightened time of anxiety for them. So if they are to get sick, they don't have as much function to begin with. So people with cystic fibrosis I talked to one person who her family has set up basically a station outside their house so they can sanitize any package, any grocery, anything they bring home from the grocery store before it comes into the house, which is something they've never done before. And, you know, like a lot of these people with other conditions, they're the ones who often rely on the health system the most. And so that kind of creates its own risk, because if you're going to a doctor's office, maybe other people are going there to get tested or for treatment. And so they're trying to avoid that. And so now, for example, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has said if people can, they should actually try to move to virtual appointments.
Then you talked to Laura Hatcher from Maryland. Her son has epilepsy and other issues. What does she have to do?
Yeah, her son has a rare form of epilepsy where if he gets an infection, it manifests in a way that he's more likely to have life-threatening seizures. So it's really serious for people. And these are kids, too. It's not just for older adults. So she was telling me that she had gone to the pharmacy one day, and she just had this spike in anxiety because there were all these people around her. She doesn't know what protections they're taking, whether they're, you know, trying to do the right practices of washing their hands and staying away from other people. And, you know, when she got home from the pharmacy, she was wondering if it was really safe for her to be around her own son, because her fear was that she would unknowingly pass the virus on to her son. And, you know, these are families for that have spent a lot of time in hospitals and in intensive care units, so they know the stress that can come with that.
Boy, it's a, you just don't think about the things that people have to go through. And so thank you for pulling on this thread of what exactly it means to be immunocompromised in an era of coronavirus. Drew Joseph, with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's find out more about what it means to be immunocompromised with a cancer patient. 61-year-old Susan Feinberg has a BRCA gene mutation that increases her risks for certain cancers, and she's fought through breast cancer, then cancer in her fallopian tubes, and just last summer, a form of ovarian cancer. She joins us now from her home on Cape Cod. And so, Susan, you've been successfully fending off the enemy within, but how do you battle this one from without?
That's a great question, Robin. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I'm fortunate, I guess, that I live alone. And so my house is my fortress for at least 10 days, probably longer. No one else has been in my house. I'm having food delivered. I have friends who will drop off food by my front door if I need something extra. And I am really restricting my outside activities. So I'm lucky enough to live close to the beach. So I go out for a walk on the beach by myself. I don't see a lot of people this time of year. And other than that, my current form of treatment is a targeted oral chemotherapy. So I get to take pills twice a day. So the only reason I need to go out is once a month I need to have my blood levels checked. So I'm really in a position where I can limit my exposure.
Yeah, well, and as you said, thankfully, because others aren't. They have to get to things like dialysis and things like that. And here you can be at home most of the time. And I'm imagining when you go out, you feel like it's you against the world. Explain why, you know, you've been on and off immune suppressing treatments.
Exactly. So 6 months ago, after I was diagnosed for the third time, the first line of treatment was traditional chemotherapy, what we all think of. So I have a port, and I was given chemotherapy once every 3 weeks through that port. And that kind of chemotherapy, traditional chemotherapy, affects every cell in your body. So your immune system is dramatically affected. And so I went through a period of 4 months last year where I was sort of practice for coronavirus. I would not see more than a couple, you know, two or three friends at a time. Now, it's obviously very, very scary. And just the thought of having to go to the hospital, there was a lot of back and forth over the past few days between myself, my oncologist, and her team. Where can I go to have my blood checked? Because going to a cancer center that has a separate entrance from the rest of the hospital is actually, for me, the best choice.
Well, and Susan, you are such a reminder why we are practicing social distancing, why we are all going to this trouble. It is for Susan Feinberg and others like her, because you went to a pharmacy to pick up a medication and you were trying to keep 6 feet away from people and a woman came up and stood right behind you. What happened when you asked her for space?
Well, at first I sort of just gave her a look and she didn't react. So I turned around again and I actually said, I pulled out the cancer card. I said, I'm very sorry. I don't mean to be pushy, but I have cancer and I would appreciate it if you would move several feet away from me. And she kind of looked at me like maybe she had never heard about the 6 foot apart rule. But she did move. She did not say a word to me. She moved. But that was enough to scare me, and I have not been into any kind of retail establishment since then.
Yeah, well, you teach us. I can't imagine how frightening it gets. I mean, cancer's one enemy that you seem to have, you know, be fighting pretty well, but then have another one come. It just doesn't feel fair.
Yeah, it is obviously especially scary when you have a life-threatening illness and you add this complication on top of it. And for me, one of the most important things that I'm doing to make sure that I feel like I'm part of a community, I have a number of different volunteer roles that I can do from home. I support other people who are affected by hereditary cancer or a national nonprofit organization called FORCE. And I can do a lot of that support remotely. So I feel like I'm helping other people who are going through the very same thing. And it's just, as you said, one sort of added thing on top of a situation that's already very stressful for people.
Yeah. Well, Susan Feiberg, we wish you all the best. People, give her space. Susan, thank you. Best to you.
You're very welcome.
Well, the elderly are also vulnerable, and nursing homes have drastically limited access to visitors. For the Austins, a couple that began dating not long after World War II, this is the first time they've been apart. Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports.
Marion Austin is petite, with short white hair and bright blue eyes. We page through old photo albums in our living room.
The wedding picture. That was who he was when I met him. Johnny Austin.
Pretty handsome guy.
So handsome. You know, the word cute.
Marion met John in New Jersey in the late 1940s. The couple raised three kids and moved to Vermont. John was a builder, but Parkinson's and dementia took their toll. He moved into the Pines, a nursing home in Rutland, in 2018. Marion has visited him nearly every day since.
This is where the for better or for worse comes in, you know?
But because of coronavirus concerns, those visits are no longer possible, and she worries John will forget her. So staff at the Pines now help the Austins connect with FaceTime.
Hello.
There she is.
Hi, honey.
We called her.
You called her?
Yeah.
Can you see me? Can you see me? John?
She's down there talking.
Marion.
Yes, I'm here. Can you see me?
I can see you now.
Marion rests her cell phone on her lap, relaxing and laughing with John and his nurse as she hears about his day.
Last night you had dinner with Lena. You two were laughing.
Yeah. Joking. Had a good time with Lena. Yeah.
Okay. But we're still married, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
We are, honey.
We'll find out when you get here.
Yeah, well, I'll get there when I can, okay? I can't get there just yet. I'll get there sometime. Okay? Yeah.
Don't forget.
I love you.
I love you.
Bye.
These visits with John are always bittersweet, she tells me, but she's grateful for them. And she trusts her husband's caregivers. The rest, she says, is out of her hands. For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
And now to those cruise ships out at sea pleading to dock in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis says no because health resources are stretched too thin. Holland America's Zaandam ship and the Rotterdam have more than 2,000 people on board, 300 Americans, many sick with flu-like symptoms, and at least four have died, though without autopsies, it's not clear if they had COVID-19. Miami Herald reporter Taylor Dalvin is here, and Taylor, we spoke a few weeks ago when passengers were being taken off another ship in Oakland, California, after some tested positive for COVID-19. KQED reports there are still more than 600 crew members on board that ship, so people on these outside Florida might be stuck for a while. Where were they trying to go?
So originally, the Zaandam ship left from Buenos Aires in early March and was scheduled to dock in Chile on March 21st. And end the cruise there. The following cruise was actually supposed to sail from Chile to Florida and arrive in Fort Lauderdale on April 7th. And it's important to note that several hundred passengers had actually planned to stay on board for that second leg to Florida. Mm. And so now the ships have made it through the Panama Canal. Chile turned them away, and countries along the route are saying they're not allowed to dock there. So they're hoping to come to Florida. They haven't rounded Cuba yet. Our local officials here in Florida say they haven't received a request to dock, a formal request yet, but we'll be looking for that today.
Well, we understand, though, that at least two people tested positive for COVID-19 before they were turned away from Chile. So if at least two people on a ship have it, you can do the exponential math. Many do. You know, they're confined to their rooms. What's going to happen when they come to Florida? I mean, are they just going to have to stay on the ship?
Well, so we have two previous examples of similar situations, the Diamond Princess in Japan and the Grand Princess in California. For the Diamond Princess, the strategy was to leave everyone on the ship and quarantine people on board. That did not end well. Over 800 people in the end were infected and several died. The Grand Princess, the strategy in California was to get people off the ship as soon as possible, either to local hospitals or to military bases to spend 14 days. Some of those people still haven't been tested, and as you mentioned, a lot of crew are still on board. So there are issues with both strategies, and we don't know yet what will happen here in Florida.
Well, just quickly, how did this happen? Because we spoke to you on March 10th, and you told us there were thousands of people getting onto cruise ships in Miami, despite, you know, what we knew at that point about coronavirus. Yes, we had leaders who were downplaying it, but still, we knew it was happening on cruise ships. I mean, I'm wondering, is there going to be some liability here afterwards that cruise ships set out with thousands of people knowing there were already problems on ships?
Yeah, there have already been lawsuits filed. People who have been infected have sued cruise companies, and I think we can expect more of that. The CDC first warned on March 8th that people should not cruise, and cruises continued until March 13th. New cruises continued until March 13th. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Not to mention the fear that cruise ship workers have. They don't have the luxury of, you know, single rooms. They've been crowded together. So we'll see how this unfolds. With Taylor Dalvin, who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. Taylor, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The COVID-19 pandemic is raising a lot of questions about leadership and about the role of America in the world. Our next guest has some thoughts about that. In his latest book, Andrew Bacevich writes about the period between the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and Donald Trump's election in 2016. Bacevich is a retired Army colonel who served in the Vietnam War and the Gulf War. His son Andrew was also in the Army. He was killed in Iraq in 2007. The new book is called The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory, and Andrew Bacevich joins us on Skype. Andrew Bacevich, you talk in this book about the Cold War being a turning point in our history. For many Americans, it is now a distant memory. So remind us what was so important about the Cold War.
Well, it's almost impossible to remember now in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. But I think the Cold War really gave definition to American life. It defined our purpose. Our purpose was to defend freedom and resist communism. And therefore, when the Cold War ended, this is what I argue in the book, Americans were left kind of wondering, well, what are we all about now?
And that we were right all along, that our way of life has to be the best one for everybody.
Well, that's what the conclusion of the Cold War seemed to demonstrate. This induced, I think, among many Americans, especially Americans in the policy world, a conviction that now the future was ours to define. And indeed, we were smart enough to figure out exactly what that future was supposed to look like.
But you write that the Cold War produced ruinous consequences. It fostered folly and waste on a colossal scale, notably in an arms race of staggering magnitude. It bred hatred, hysteria, and intolerance, creating conditions rife with opportunities for demagogues. It warped political priorities, subordinating the well-being of people to the imperatives of state security. It provided a pretext for murder and mayhem, even if the victims tended not to be citizens of the United States or USSR.
Yes. And as I was writing this book in 2019, that is the judgment that I arrived at. More important than my own judgment was the perspective of American leaders back in 1989. And that perspective was one that viewed the Cold War in simplistic and Manichaean terms, and therefore concluded that when the Berlin Wall fell, that something great and wonderful had occurred, and that that wonderful occurrence was going to define the future, or perhaps more specifically, would position the United States to define the future. And that was the attitude that informed the post-Cold War presidencies of Bill Clinton, of George W. Bush, and of Barack Obama.
And when you look at those presidencies in this book, it doesn't sound like you look very fondly on any of those presidencies.
Well, the book is, in a sense, less about the actors, these presidents. So the problem is not with Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. The problem was with the ideas that shaped their presidencies. I mean, one of those ideas was a belief in globalization, a belief that globalization was going to make everybody rich, when in fact what we know is that globalization has created vast disparities of wealth. I mean, a second idea that came out at the end of the Cold War was a belief in American military supremacy, that we would be able to address threats and dispose of them expeditiously, when in fact what actually occurred was a pattern of interventionism that led to us being involved in terribly wasteful, misguided, and mismanaged wars. I also argue that the end of the Cold War gave rise to a deeply defective conception of individual freedom that basically led to the abandonment of traditional moral norms and also detaching the idea of freedom from any sense of collective responsibility. That too, I think, has contributed to negative outcomes that we see in American society in all kinds of ways, whether we're talking about drug epidemics or morbid obesity or the destruction of the family and so on. And to complete the thought, my interpretation is if you want to know why an incompetent like Donald Trump could become president in 2016 is because a sufficient number of people believed that he was going to overturn the post-Cold War system. Sufficient number of people believe that to put him in office.
Well, you say that President Trump did not create the conditions in which the campaign of 2016 was to take place. He demonstrated a knack for translating those conditions into votes. You write, here the moment met the man.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that he's a demagogue, but demagogues have their own talents. And this particular one, I think, saw the opportunity to exploit the policy failures of the post-Cold War period so as to advance his own political ambitions.
So do you think that in a post-Trump era, whenever that happens, that the U.S. is going to get on what you would see as the right path? Or do you think that this is bigger than any one president at this point and, you know, we've moved in a certain direction and there's no turning back?
Well, it's certainly bigger than any one president. I mean, I think once we get through this pandemic, there will be a great opportunity for reflection and reconsideration. Now, that was reflection and reconsideration that should have happened in 1989 at the end of the Cold War and didn't. So now we have a second chance. And I'm struck by the fact that, you know, here we are approaching the election of 2020, and the Democrats seem likely to nominate somebody who voted for the invasion of Iraq, just as they did in the election of 2016. And I point out that small fact as simply one indication of the absence of learning and reflection. I mean, how can it be that in 2020 the Democrats are going to nominate for the presidency somebody who voted in favor of the most catastrophic foreign policy decision of the last quarter of a century?
So if it was Biden versus Trump in 2020, which it looks like it probably will be, which side would you be on?
Well, I'll probably do what I did in 2016, and that is to say vote, but not vote for the candidate of either major party.
What about the presidency in general, Andrew Bacevich? You make the point that over the last few decades, the role of president has gotten much more powerful than it used to be, and not for the better.
Well, I mean, especially after the end of the Cold War, we began to think that the president of the United States was the president of the entire world or the president of the universe. Again, it could be, ironically, a benefit of this crisis will be that we now see the error of entrusting our well-being in the hands of any one person. The person who supposedly is our leader is utterly incapable of leading. And I think that tells us something about rethinking our political system, returning to the principles of federalism, of trying to ensure that, and it'll be a steep climb, but trying to ensure that the Congress once more plays the role intended by the framers of the Constitution. You know, this notion that the president is the be-all and end-all has always been a deeply flawed idea, and that is particularly the case today.
Let me just finally bring you back to the moment that we're all experiencing right now. What would you want to see from the United States in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think that the pandemic itself completely absorbs our attention, and understandably. So I don't think it's realistic to expect that in this moment, the American people are going to pay much attention to anything other than surviving this moment. That said, once this moment passes, I would hope that there would be a mood of reflection on many topics, one of which would be our political system, one of which would be the role that we imagine we should play in the world. So this could turn out to be a major turning point in American history. And I would hope that it would be a turning point that would lead to something better than we have experienced since the Cold War ended.
That is Andrew Bacevich, whose new book is called The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Andrew Bacevich, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
As we know, governments around the world have shut borders and closed airports because of the coronavirus, and the State Department says it's now tracking some 30,000 Americans who asked for help getting home. From member station WAMU, Daniela Cheslow has this story.
Yunus Katiri flew to Morocco to visit his parents, and he got stuck when the country suspended international flights to contain the spread of the coronavirus. Katiri has lived in Farmington Hills, Michigan for the last 12 years, and he says it's hard to be far from his wife and three adult children.
My heart and my thoughts and my mind are all in Michigan right now.
Katiri says the U.S. Embassy notified him of a flight out of Morocco, but without enough time for him to drive to the airport. The State Department says it's working at full bore to repatriate American citizens. It says it brought back more than 25,000 Americans from 50 countries since the end of January, including nearly 600 people from Peru this past weekend. NPR spoke to more than a dozen travelers over the past week. Many of them were repatriated, although it wasn't always easy. Alberto Cuevas of Chicago says when he got stuck in Honduras, he contacted the U.S. Embassy.
At first, I was not receiving any information from the embassy. I started to get frustrated.
He joined a Facebook group for stranded citizens and called his senators. Late last week, Cuevas says, the U.S. embassy called him and told him he was booked on a flight to Louisiana. Like most of the stranded Americans, he'd have to pay for his ticket. Former U.S. Ambassador Barbara Bodine says the scale of this challenge, thousands of people scattered around the world as borders close, is unprecedented. She oversaw the effort to get Americans out of Kuwait just before the Gulf War in 1990, and she says Americans need to have realistic expectations.
Our responsibility is not necessarily to send a military C-130 to pick up Americans. Our job is to help find a way for a citizen to get out safely. not necessarily cheaply.
The State Department says it's prioritizing the elderly and sick and working as fast as it can. Some delays are beyond its control. In a briefing, a State Department official said it struggled to get timely approvals from Peruvian authorities. Khadija Ismail was marooned on her vacation in Peru on March 16th and says at first she heard very little from the U.S. Embassy. Finally, after 11 days, she got a message telling her to meet in Lima for a flight to Miami.
I can't even express how happy and grateful I am to be home.
Ismail is an emergency medicine resident in Los Angeles. Her hospital has 8 cases of the coronavirus, and she says she's eager to get to work. For NPR News, I'm Daniela Cheslow.
Well, after COVID-19, how about we all crowd the great outdoors? And hopefully in about a year, there will be a new nature trail at the Letchworth State Park in upstate New York that will be the first in the nation designed specifically for people with an autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. The state donated the land and private fundraising is underway. Eric Coulisade is New York State's park commissioner. Eric, what will this look like and how did this start at this stunning park?
Letchworth is really one of our flagship state parks. Its nickname is the Grand Canyon of the East, so it's already a place where a million people a year come. And we have a group of volunteers. They'd seen parents coming with children with ASD specifically because there's a lot of waterfalls, there's a lot of calming features of the park. It had become a destination, and it seemed like what a great opportunity to do something that would really bring in a population that you don't necessarily associate with outdoor recreation. It's meant to be a mile-long loop trail, and then 8 stations set off on the side along the way, a tactile station where you can go and feel moss and pieces of wood and other things like that. There'll be a sort of a sound station where you can play instruments, natural instruments. It's also a place where, you know, if there's acting out, if there's issues, you know, people don't have to run in embarrassment. It's really meant to be a place where we can all learn about each other and provide, you know, really opportunities for these people to enjoy the outdoors.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. A station where you can listen to the music that's made through nature, have sensory awareness that's not overwhelming, because that we know that's an issue with some people on the spectrum.
You know, it's meant to be a place of acceptance, right? Part of the reason we have these stations that are a little bit set off from the main trail is that, you know, people who need a break or need to get off the trail, get a little away, there are places of isolation. But the idea is that even the general population is there. I think it's going to be a lovely nature trail that I think anyone's going to enjoy and maybe even learn about people with ASD, right?
Yeah. Plans for cuddle swings, gliders, alone zones, as you said. And we understand the first phase of the fundraising campaign has brought in $2 million. Advocacy groups are trying to raise the rest.
But I think what we hope we have is a model that can be replicated fairly easily across the country in all kinds of landscapes.
Yeah. That's New York Parks Commissioner Eric Coulisade talking about plans for the first-of-its-kind Autism Nature Trail in upstate New York's Letchworth State Park. Commissioner, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
What a great idea. And we know many people want to help make it a reality, so we will hook you up at hereandnow.org. We have links and pictures, hereandnow.org. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I have to say, by the way, Robin, that for all of us right now, just being outside, you appreciate it more than ever before.
Right, and to have this new great trail for people who might never ever have hiked, what a great thing to dream about now.
Absolutely.